Oh. Spontaneous applause. Now, that's the first time this week. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much indeed for joining us during your lunch hour, which is fantastic. I was lucky enough as a fan over some 13 years to work with, I worked it out, four England senior coaches, plus Hope Powell, who did so much to help to develop English women's football, and indeed football for women well beyond these shores. I always remember Sven-Göran Eriksson saying to me, the time to worry about England players is when they aren't playing, aren't practicing, aren't eating, or aren't sleeping. Now, you might have said the same about him, but that is another story. My next guests know all about what can go wrong in life, even if you're having fantastic success on and off the pitch for your club and indeed for your country. One of them has captained his club and country and been to prison. All of them have seen their lives changed by the Sporting Chance Clinic, which does so much fantastic work for sporting stars who've lost their way just a little. I'd like you to welcome formally the CEO of Sporting Chance, my friend Colin Bland, and two of our greatest former players, Kelly Smith and Tony Adams. Colin, let's start. How widespread do you believe, can you estimate, the addiction problems that Tony and Kelly have suffered from in professional sport, and especially in football? How widespread are those problems?
I think firstly, there are other problems other than addiction. If we're just looking at addiction, I mean, a lot of research would say that just the general population, there's a figure of about 10%. Always the debate is whether that's higher in professional sport or lower in professional sport. One of the things that the charity has done over the last 15 years is try to create a pathway for those people to try and come and get confidential support. But in that time, when we first started 15 years ago, we were predominantly dealing with addiction as main thing, but now we're also dealing with anxiety, depression, and a lot of other mental health problems.
Tony, why did you... You were absolutely instrumental in setting this up. Why did you do it?
Well, you don't hear that every day, do you? You said captain of your country, captain of Arsenal, and prison. They don't usually go together, the three kind of terminologies. And I had my own set of experiences, and when I was trying to get sober and clean, 1996, long time now, 19 years ago, without a drink and a drug, there was nothing available to me. I didn't know where to go. I was just, despair and bewilderment and confusion and, you know, and I didn't feel like I could go to George Graham, you know. I think he might have ripped my head off. Weakness, maybe the other teammates. I didn't feel like I could share it with anybody, really, the things that I was completely trapped. So when I did finally threw it in the towel and got clean and sober after about 18 months with fellow professionals asking me, how did you do it? How did you get clean and sober? I went, maybe I need to look at something and put a... Because I'm no psychotherapist, you know. I've got my own set of skills that I do, I think. But I didn't know how to get other people clean and sober. But I went through a process and I got them people in place to set up the Sporting Chance.
So it was who you knew and who you could take into your confidence.
Absolutely. I took my ex-wife down to a treatment centre down in Somerset, Clouds, dropped her off for she had the problem and not me. She was took crack cocaine. I went back and I drank for another 6 months and I'd kind of admitted really that I had a problem, and my mother-in-law said, why don't you go and see someone for help, and gave me a number of a guy called James West, and that was the start of my journey. and 15 years later, James West, my clinical director at the Sporting Chance. So, and 71 now, so we're looking for a new guy. But he's been responsible for many people to get clean and sober.
Kelly, no two cases are the same. But when you were having your problems, what was the sensation? Was it helplessness? Was it hopelessness? Was it, who do I talk to? What was it?
Yeah, you're right. No two cases are the same. And I started my struggles in 2001 when I was out in the States. I suffered my first major injury. I had a torn ACL, and I wasn't a very confident person at the time. I was quite shy. And my way of expressing myself was through my football. And when that was taken away from me, I didn't know how to be in society with my teammates or anything like that. I didn't know how to socialise. So I just turned to drink, and that made me, that was my escape. That's how I started to feel better. And just, you know, it was just a whirlwind, you know, going downwards after that, because it just made me feel better, and that was my coping mechanism.
It wasn't affecting your performances on the pitch because you were injured, is what you're saying, is
yes,
that right?
Yes, yeah, definitely. You know, my main drinking time was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd done all my rehab, not a problem, got through that, and then I'd come back by myself and I'd just drown my sorrows, upset that I couldn't play, thinking poor, poor me, just really, you know, self kind of denial that I couldn't get out onto the field and express myself and do those things, score a goal. That made me feel good. Playing in front of thousands, that's why I played the game. And it was just taken away from me. I didn't know how to handle it, and I just drunk, and that made me feel better.
How typical are those stories?
I think they are very typical. I mean, as you said right at the beginning, no two stories are exactly the same. But, you know, what is true is that, you know, quite often, as Tony said, people don't want to go and talk to their coach. They don't want to go and talk to their club. They want a safe place where they can come and a confidential place where they will get good advice and they can feel safe doing that. And the other thing that we hear a lot is that problems come along when people start to pick up injuries. So,
and Sporting Chance doesn't just deal with football players.
No, I would still say that 85% of our work is with football. But we also do a lot of work with rugby. We work with rugby league and we work with boxing, and we actually work with darts as well.
So. And so how does the process work? I mean, do you have a residential complex?
We have three key departments. We have the only residential clinic treating addictive disorders in the world, which is exclusively for sportsmen. That's a 26-day residential.
Men and women.
That is a 26-day residential process that is very similar to many other treatment processes, but it's exclusively for sportsmen and women, and takes into account the physical part of our illness as well. And then we manage a network of 60 therapists and counsellors throughout the country that support people while they're playing at their clubs or when they return from treatment. And our third department is we have an education department that goes into every club in the country once a year and does a preventative programme for young players as well.
Tony, should outsiders, should fans be sympathetic?
I think that's a question for the fans.
Yeah.
What
do you think?
I don't think football stands out. Society's changed, but I don't think football stands outside of society. It's always been the case, you know, I earn a lot more than my mates when I left school, you know. The disparity now is huge, but I still at that time, 1979, I still earn more than my buddies. And sympathetic. I think education's been really key for the charity, and it's better than it's ever been. You know, there was no education when I joined the club. When I joined the club, the ex-pros took me down the pub. You know, that's where we went to on a Tuesday after training, bang. That's where they'd take me. They don't tend to do that now. You know, a lot of good things have come into the
game.
Does
it still happen?
I don't think they take them down the pub. I think the illness of addiction is gone different directions. I describe them like milkshakes. You know, chocolate milkshake's alcohol, but you know, you've got the internet now, and gambling's a massive one. You know, at the moment, I think Colin will correct me, I think 70% of our clients that come through, patients, are gambling addicts. It's been a big shift away from booze to gambling.
In the women's game, were you conscious of other people with similar problems?
Certainly not, no. I didn't have any idea. Obviously, I knew I had a problem, but I didn't want to speak to my manager. I was out the States, in the States. My parents were obviously living in England. I thought that I could deal with it by myself. I just didn't want to tell any of my close friends. I was embarrassed. And that's where, you know, you cycle out of control. And it got to a point where I just knew that I needed help, or I knew I was so suicidal that I was actually scared that I would probably take my life. So I took it into my own hands and, you know, spoke to my dad in England, and he got on the next plane out and come got me. I was only 21, 22 at the time. And he pretty much saved me, because who knew where I would have ended up. He, you know, sold my car, he shipped my dog over. I was just in such a bad way that I'm glad that I reached out to him when I did, because if I didn't, I probably wouldn't be here.
I know it's a hypothetical question, but if you had not had a serious injury,
yeah,
would this have happened?
I think so. I think I've always had an addictive personality, an addictive trait. I had my first drink when I was 6 years old. I always wanted to know what it felt like
When did you have your first drink?
I didn't have my first drink until I got injured. You know, it's a characteristic. Every summer I got pissed. You know, when I didn't have my first addiction was football. That's all. It did it for me. It did it for me. But when I didn't have football, I ended up no life skills, no life tools. And booze was just like the secret. I was king for the day. The minute that went down, I was, oh, hallelujah. You know, I'd found a wonderful drug. But it actually took over my whole life, 12 years of drinking. But at the start, I got my fifth metatarsal. I did my foot, they put me in plaster up here, and I hobbled down the pub at 17 and went, unbelievable. And in that, even in that 6 weeks, I didn't have one pint and go home. I got shit-faced, you know, absolutely out my tree, drunk alcoholically, wet the bed, into fights, put crutches over people's heads. Even then, it got better, the foot. I got on with my career and I got my first drug back. But every summer, it was fueled with alcoholics experiences. And then finally took over my career, you know, the career that I loved. It was irrelevant, really. I had to save my life before the game, to be honest with you.
I was lucky enough to know Tony for a little bit of this period, and I've been proud to know him since. And he's very conscious, and not least because he worked under a manager called Arsene Wenger, the way that huge strides have been made in the past 20 years in terms of physical development of players, in terms of their nutrition, in terms of the way they live. But in terms of mental health, which is a coming subject in schools, for example, I don't think we made half as much progress, if not less. Is that fair, or is that just
I don't my know if idea? I don't know if it is fair. I mean, I know today that any player that's a member of the PFA that has a problem can pick up a telephone, phone a 24-hour helpline, and will receive support within 24 hours of making that phone call. They can access counselling within an hour of their house, or therapy. They can have a mental health assessment. They can access the only residential clinic in the world. Now, I don't think that existed 15 years ago. That's just the development of our charity.
Would it have existed without this guy?
Sporting Chance wouldn't have existed without this charity, and I would also without Tony. And I think the charity, I've only been privileged to be in this role for 3 years now. There was much work done by James West and Peter Kay before I arrived, and my belief is that the charity leads the way in the world of mental health and sport. What I think is fair is I don't think there is parity between the way people see mental health issues and physical issues. Coaches will quite accept that I can't play because I've torn this or my knee's bad. But if you're upright and walking, you might be suffering from an acute depressive illness, you might be suffering from an addictive disorder, you're well enough to play and you get your treatment in the down season.
Did you play when you shouldn't have played?
Pissed twice.
Oh, pissed twice?
Yeah.
Only twice?
Only twice, you know. Football was enough for me. You have to, long periods, football was enough for me. But certainly at the end, I couldn't got the timing wrong. Well, this is a rule, you know, we're very devious. 48 hours, you're not supposed to drink. But playing snooker on a Thursday night and drinking 8 pints of Guinness is not drinking, it's playing snooker, isn't it? So...
It's an interesting description.
Yeah, and because everybody was... There was a lot of people, not abusing it like that, but a lot of people in the game were abusing alcohol. And it wasn't out of place to people after the game to get absolutely smashed out of their heads. You know, it was in the game at that period.
And it was almost encouraged.
Encouraged. There was a lot of people that wasn't doing it as well. I've realised now I'm sober that a lot of people were going straight home to the families and stuff. But people like me, addicts that couldn't leave it alone, were dragging people and taking them down the pub, yeah.
Let's understand this, Colin, as well. Where does the work of Sporting Chance start? When somebody comes to you as a resident, what happens?
That's specific. I mean, the work of Sporting Chance starts actually as soon as someone picks up their telephone or is courageous enough to reach out their hand and ask for help. They can speak to someone 24 hours a day. So our work starts then. And our work finishes when they're back at their club or back in their life.
Do you cure them?
I don't think... I mean, if we're specifically talking about addictive disorders, I think, you know, you do not cure addictive disorders. People are in remission and they have an ongoing process that they will keep themselves well. But we give people tools to be able to do that. And there are many guys that are playing top-flight football and top-flight rugby that actually look after themselves and stay clean from substances, gambling and alcohol in doing so with the tools that they've been given by Sporting Chance.
Let's go right back, Kelly. Was there a... You've said that there was this injury, a very serious injury. How long were you out to actually?
7 months.
And you were on the other side of the Atlantic?
Yeah.
But can you... And yet you say even if you hadn't had an injury, serious injury, you think something like this would have happened.
Most of my binges, or would you say, were related to my injuries. I just couldn't handle the fact that I wasn't playing. And for me, just getting on it and being out of it, that's how I coped.
But was there a moment before all this that you think that it started... That the seed was sown, if you like that expression.
As I said, I tasted my first bit of alcohol when I was 6 years old. I remember my parents sitting in their front room, and I wanted to drink the red wine that they had at dinner, and I snuck off to the refrigerator and just necked it, and then puked up loads of red wine an hour or so later on my grey carpet. So for me, I just loved that feeling, and I was kind of always seeking to just be numb. And I think the injuries, they set me along the way. I do still think they probably would have had a problem if my injuries would have happened, but that was my clutch kind of thing.
This is not meant as a rude question in any way, but do you hold your parents in any way responsible?
No, not at all. No.
Not at all.
No, because they've been a great support network for me since now and fully behind me and everything that I do.
Where was the seed sown with you?
But it's not. I think of it as a lift. For me, I think of it as a lift going down, down and down and down, you know. And, you know, prison didn't stop me drinking. You know, I went into prison and there was no education in prison about my behaviour. You know, I was in there for drink driving. I came out. I had 6 years of drink driving. You know, I got straight back in the car and got pissed one Saturday night. I'd done it regular. There's no education about my illness of addiction. You know, where I just threw it, you know, and I'm a big advocate now for not putting people in prison under 6 months. I don't think, especially without education. You know, there's another issue. But think of it as a lift for me going down and down and down. And the football could so long fill that void inside of me that I felt, you know, and I think it was just always hollow, and it's not my parents. You know, my parents didn't understand, you know, and they did the best they could.
I was lucky enough to meet your parents famously one Saturday morning, and they were... I always remember your father's fish. He loved his fish, didn't he? And there, And yet you don't blame them at all?
No, I think I take responsibility for my actions, you know, and it's not saying, oh, I'm a recovering addict and blame the parents type of thing. No, it was me. I was the one that put the booze down my neck, you know. I was the one that got into the trouble. I was meeting in prison. It was all the time, you know. They had the press at their door, and I feel really sorry. But I had an opportunity for the 19 years of therapy that I've been under is to say sorry to them and the stuff that I put them through. You get to make amends. The day at a time, not picking up a drink for me, I've been able to live a life of dignity and respect. I got my self-worth back. I got my self-respect back. I started to live again. And you get opportunities to go and do things like this and see the world that, I'm free as a bird now. You know, the head used to kill me. You know, it used to be in now. Sorry, David.
You've both been actually on the pitch hugely successful. Did success on the pitch, was it a help or was it a hindrance in this direction?
I would say it was a help. I mean, I loved to play in the biggest stadiums with the biggest crowds and perform. I loved that kind of pressure. It's when I couldn't get to do that, that's what made me angry and mad and depressed and want to pick up a drink. So that was, what happened. There's no other job like it. Scoring a goal, the euphoria that you get, that feeling, it's just out of this world. And obviously, when you do come to the end of your career or you retire, I don't feel like you're ever going to replace that feeling of walking out in front of 70,000 at Wembley, scoring a goal. It's just, you can't explain it. So when that, you can't chase that. That's where it was very difficult for me.
Were you any better when you won or when you lost?
What do you think?
No, I ask, did you drink more when you...
I was certainly a better player. Physically, I was a better player. 6 years sober playing football, won 2 doubles in that time and enjoyed every moment, the highs as well as the lows. Yeah. Sober and clean, it's the best feeling in the world. Why get pissed on it? I never understand that. You know, it's madness, and I can see that today. You know, you've just scored a goal, you've just won a trophy, and then you want to suppress that feeling? What is wrong with you? You know what I mean? I can understand the bad ones when you've had the bad game or missed it or got the own goal. I can understand going, well, get out of it. But the good ones? I don't understand that. But so 6 years physically was absolute a joy, David. Mm. It was a joy. I wasn't breaking sweat. You know, after struggling to get on the pitch, there was one game before Man City, and I was thinking, I'm not going to get through 90 minutes here. I'm knackered. Going onto the pitch, I'm thinking, I'm not going to get through. You know, hoping that the ball stays up that end and doesn't come back this end. Luckily, we won 2-0 when I didn't have a lot to do.
Do you remember making the FA Cup draw the first time?
Oh, shit.
Well, I do. I remember him making the FA Cup draw the first time. And we got him through it. And the second time, my ambition was always that he would make the FA Cup draw when he was sober. And you did it in the end.
I did. Ray Parler tells a story on the circuit. It's like that, wasn't it? On its own, number 16.
Yeah, that's entirely correct.
You never thought I'd get the hand at my house. I was falling asleep on the balls.
It was very difficult.
He said, get his hand out in the open. Get his hand out of there. Someone
that's
get
right.
him off the stage.
We had to. It was a night. There's no plan B for that. That's the problem. Kelly, another thing that struck me about when I read about your experience was the loneliness of, here you are, a Brit, having chosen to play in America, and yet you seem to spend hours and hours on your own. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, the reason why I went to the States was because England women's football at that time was nowhere what it is now. So my dream of being a professional footballer was in America. And I don't think I was mentally ready or confident enough of a person to go over there and do that at my time of life. I was only 17, so I left all my friends and family behind. I wasn't that confident, and I really struggled socially. I mean, I've changed and I've developed and I've become more confident now, the older I've got. But at that point in my life, I just couldn't speak to people. So at university, just drinking and partying all the time, and it just made me feel so good. It made me the person who I wanted to be. I was confident, I was talkative. I dreamed of being that person when I was drunk, and I couldn't do that sober. You know, I'd see people the next morning that I'd been having a great conversation with that night, and then I'd see him walking down the hallway, and I couldn't say, look him in the eye. You know, I was that low within myself because alcohol just made me feel amazing.
What's interesting, observing these two talking, Colin, is that they nod a lot when the other is speaking. Mm. And I mean, is that common, that the people you deal with understand each other?
I think there's a process of identification. So, yeah, I recognise that. And that is part of recovery. A couple of other things you sort of said, that, and I think you were alluding to, what do you blame for why you've got this problem? And I think we work with adult players. You know, if you're going to start blaming people for how you are, I think it's okay to understand your past, but don't blame it. You know, take responsibility for your illness, and that's what we provide, is a place where people can do that.
And
but
do you,
David? Sorry, if I cut across, but identification is why I sent it out. I had two guys in recovery, a postman and a British Rail tube station driver. And I don't know what it's like to drive a train, and I don't know what it's like to deliver mail at 6 a.m, but I knew what it's like to play football at a high level in front of a stadium and all the injuries and all that type of stuff. And one person, and I have an addictive illness, you know, so that's why I did it. That was the start, and the identification I get is why we nod, because we've both been to the place, and hopefully no one else has to go there, but we've both been there. Sorry, Colin.
Well, the other thing that seems to cross sports as well, because, you know, currently, you know, we're working with maybe two football players, a boxer and a rugby league player, and there seems to be a bond between sports as well.
Do you have foreign equivalents of sporting jobs?
No, I mean, I've not been contradicted yet, but I still say that, you know, we are the only treatment provider in the world that exclusively treats sportsmen. I mean, there are other treatment providers that take sportsmen in, but our service is tailored by sportsmen for sportsmen.
We've got 12 sports therapies that goes alongside the mental and emotional stuff. So there's golf therapy, the equine therapy. You know, we get people cycling or swimming, you know, this type of stuff if they want to do it, you know. Healthy addictions.
Yeah. Sorry.
And currently, I mean, because we work very closely with Rugby League, we're working with a partner in Australia to maybe set up a Sporting Chance Australia at the moment, which would mirror our services. And I think people from other parts of the world do look at Sporting Chance and think, actually, that is unique. We do have players flying from other countries to do treatment with us as well.
How are you financed these days? I mean, are the sporting authorities helpful, or could they do more?
I think Sporting Chance was solely financed initially by Tony Adams, and I think I'm right in this, is that, you know, some of the people may have read Tony's book Addicted. With the proceeds from that book, Tony established Sporting Chance. In saying that money was only ever going to last so long, and our partner for over the last 12 years has been the Professional Footballers Association, who have been our partner and our major funder for the last decade and plus.
And the FA and the Premier League?
All of which are stakeholders with us and buy various services from us. Could we do more if we had more money? The answer is yes. Are we well supported? I think the answer is also yes.
Something I haven't understood in all this is who knew? You said older players would take you up the pub, right? And you talked about fighting this, Kelly, effectively on your own. Did your fellow players at Arsenal know that you had a big problem? Did your managers know this?
I was the running joke, really. I kept falling off the wagon. You know, I've got a couple of weeks and be back on the piss again, you know, after the game. So I'm not drinking. So I was a kind of running joke. And had to go my own journey. George's good Scottish. He's not an addict. George Graham said there was no understanding of the illness. And he occasionally got a letter from someone writing in saying about Tony's behaviour, but I was doing a bloody good job for the club, so there's a there's a balance, there's a conflict there. You know, you've got this captain who's winning trophies, playing well for you, but on the other respect, you're getting letter after letter and you know, people saying what an arsehole this guy is and things like that. You know, you go, ooh. So, and the other players, a lot of them were drinking with me. I ruined about six or seven marriages, must be said, of ex-players.
You personally?
I think so. I dragged them around the world, and some of them just thought I was an idiot. And, you know, Martin Keown comes tonight. He avoided me at all costs. He just thought I was off my trolley. And then I avoided him because of that situation. But, yeah, I was kind of club captain. But when I finally got it and got to the end of my drinking, I knew that he had actually beaten me, and I found a way out through therapy, through going to AA, through with an enormous amount of work on myself, and through rejection. My first wife bombed me out, which really hurt, and it took me, never been rejected, you can't reject me, it really hurt though, and I didn't know where to deal with that. It accelerated me to the bottom. I finally got it, then I got all the lads together, but I knew at a day at a time I was never going to drink again. You know, I knew I had the tools, and it happens for some people like that, some people it doesn't, but it did for me. And I got sat them all down, and I said, look, I'm not going to drink again, guys. And Wright, I think Ian Wright stood up and went, you've got some bottle tone, and you like that, and made a joke of it. But they knew as well, and they got instant respect. They saw the state of me, and they knew that I was in bother. And they didn't know how to help me.
Kelly, did other people know?
No, a lot of my drinking was done in secret. I'd drink by myself, and then similar story, I'd just get in my car and I'd run out of alcohol. I'd drive myself to the pub and sit there and drink by myself. So.
And then drive yourself home?
Yeah. Lucky enough, I never got killed anyone, got into a car crash, because God forbid. I'm not proud of that, but that's how low you are, and it's very selfish and not the right behaviour that you want to drive. But you're in that moment and you want to get more alcohol, and you go out and you find it.
So your aspiration now, a sporting chance?
We've had we've had a lot of growth over the last few years, establishing a large network of counsellors. I think aspiration-wise, I would like to see a day where mental health issues had more parity with physical health in sport. And the work we can do in education, I think I would like to see that day. Meanwhile, I think that, you know, to create a safe and confidential place where sports people feel safe to come forward and ask for help is what Tony wanted to establish. My mission is to make sure that happens. As you know, we are working very closely with football, we're working with rugby, there's so many other sports out there as well that don't receive the support that some sports get. So it would be nice to have a day where those people could get help too.
Has anybody got a question they're burning to ask? The guy over here.
Hello, my name is Joseph Vandellos.
Can you stand up?
Yes.
And
what a speaker.
That's all right. Just give us plenty of voice.
No problem. My name is Joseph Vandellos. I'm a sports lawyer from Barcelona, Spain. My question, well, first of all, congratulate you for also winning this match. But beyond this, my question, and coming back to what Tony, I'm sorry, was saying, that he didn't know what to do, and my question would be the following: how would you recommend your father, your brother, your friends to approach you, and in what way they could approach you so it doesn't bother you, so you gain confidence in explaining them your problem?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Family, it's a family illness, and they didn't understand. We do family day, family weekend actually, and obviously relationships change. And I'm going to speak to these four guys in the clinic at the moment, and I usually go in on the last week to talk to them and ask the things about how the relationship and gaining trust back from your family members. And a lot of the family like you're sick as well. You know, for me, you know, my first wife, you know, as long as she was down there, it made me feel better. You know, she's the druggie. So we kind of use people like that at times. But when that person gets well, you're like, the fear comes in and you go, oh, this person's changed. And the only reason that we were together, because we were sick together, you know, and all of a sudden, if you change and you become well, then things happen. And if there's a lack of understanding, a lack of education in that area, then it's tricky. Now, if you see a family member that's suffering and having a hard time, what I suggest you do is just give it to the experts. You know, that's all I did. Just give the number of the Spalding Chance, and that's all you can do. And let the experts deal with it. As Paul Merson says, if I want a haircut, go into the hairdressers, you know. I'm not the man to ask how to get people clean and sober. The Sporting Chance are. So just get the number, give it to your friend, your brother, your wife, and say, look, go and get yourself some help if you're worried about someone. That's all I do.
Yeah, there's a gentleman here on the front, on the third row, and then I'll come to you, sir. Yeah.
Hello, Pedro Rico, Player Pro.
Give us plenty of voice.
I have a question for Tony and a question for Colin. Tony, how did your support system change when Arsene Wenger joined the club? Obviously, you know, George Graham was a completely different character. what kind of support systems were there for you, but also for new players that entered the club, and how would they treat you differently and introduced into a certain philosophy, a new philosophy? And also for Colin, have you ever been, or do you often get approached by managers who identify a problem with a particular player and say, hey, you guys need to talk to this guy, he's out of his trolley?
And the manager. So I'll go really quickly then. Arsene Wenger grew up in a pub. He knew how alcohol affected people. I was actually six weeks clean and sober when he came to the club, and was living a great life. I'd found the answer before he came to the club. So when the pupil's ready, the teacher appears. That was the case with me and Arsene. He's a great man, a lovely man. Can't defend for the life of him, but that's another story. Colin.
And your question is fairly similar to the first one. We quite often we get approaches from clubs that are worried about players and they don't know how to have the conversation. You know, it's the elephant in the room where sometimes people do know, but we don't know what to say and we don't know what to do. So we do support people in those approaches, but quite often it is about signposting and making sure that there's a pathway for them to get help. And the other time, you know, it's, you know, take a risk. Better have that conversation by mistake than not have that conversation by mistake. You know, so quite often we'll encourage people to signpost them, give them the information, but you know, talk to someone rather than about someone is quite often what we will say to people.
And what we've done with the LMA as well is educating the managers. It's important that they know the players. And plus, we've had three managers through, I think, in the last few years.
I was going to ask you that question. Managers and coaches are part of Sporting Chance?
We do, and Tony's right, actually, in the last 18 months, we've had three managers and several coaching staff. And a lot of them come through because one of the, we're talking about injury and all the I can't play. One of the biggest times that people get the fact that they can't play is actually when they retire from the game. So we also support a lot of retired players. And some of the managers we support are also retired players. So we offer to the whole sport. We work with the LMA that also work with another organisation, and managers come through there. And quite often coaches will approach us just because they know about us.
Gentleman over there.
Tom Grant from SoccerX. I was just wondering how you go about, I know you mentioned education briefly at the start there, how do you go about educating the certain generation where maybe between 16 to 20, where it's the most difficult age to educate? I'm just talking about, you know, sporting people in general. From my own experience, they tend to be the kind of people that don't see the long-term career. They kind of think they're immortal, they're going to last forever. They don't really foresee the problems. I'm not necessarily talking about alcoholism, but, you know, just the depression of if they do get an injury at some point, they feel like they're never going to get injured and they don't know how to cope with that. I'm just wondering how exactly you can go about implementing that to somebody who might be quite stubborn to listen to to what you have to say?
Both league football education that take care of the all football clubs below the Premier League, and Premier League education that look after all the academies in the Premier League by educational seminars from Sporting Chance Clinic. Our seminars are run by ex-professional football players, and there's information that's given about various lifestyle issues, and they'll also hear the story of someone, an ex-professional, that's got into problems. For some of those, I always think that, you know, for every room full of young men that we talk to, you know, for some of those people, it will be interesting, but they're never going to get into problems. For some of them, it will be interesting, and if they do get into problems, they will know where to go. And for others, they're always going to get into problems, and they need to know when to go when they get into problems. But the other thing that we have is we do that all 92 football clubs. Under 18s and under 21s will see someone from Sporting Chance every year. So we will do a seminar with them every year. And for some of those, it's not then they get into problem. They get into the first team, they go and play abroad. But it's just getting the name out there and getting the awareness out there that we can do. It's rare these days, but it still happens that we get a contact from someone that says, I didn't know you existed. We have a press policy where you won't see our name in the press connected to any stories or any people like that. It doesn't overly interest me that someone that reads the Daily Mail on a Sunday knows what we do. What actually interests me is a young player sitting in a dressing room knows what we do. So that's where we do our education. So.
Kelly, you'll excuse me asking a football question. Pure and simple. Our women did rather well in the World Cup.
They did.
Where is women's football now? Is it on the development continuum? Is it going to? Is this its highest point? Can it go higher?
Well, coming off the back of the Olympics in 2012, you know, reaching 75,000 at Wembley, we thought that was kind of the pinnacle, and it kind of. We missed the boat. It kind of faded away, and we didn't build on that momentum. Now that the England women's team won bronze at the at the World Cup, BBC covered all their games. So you built this journey. You built a rapport with the players. We've never really had that in the last couple of tournaments. So now they're whole household names, and the league attendances are up in the FAWSL, so the game seems to be moving in the right direction. Obviously, the FA Cup final was at Wembley, first ever FA Cup final. It is next year also. So the FA seem to be obviously promoting it a little bit more. With that comes, obviously, the players are now on full-time contracts. They're professional athletes. They're able to train as a professional. I still think, you know, there's still a little bit to go in terms of developing the game grassroots level. But it seems to be heading in a good way. But obviously, the national team needs to be, you know, doing well at these tournaments to keep the profile on the game.
Should the men's clubs do more than they are? Won't mention any names, but there'll be one club in this city that hasn't hasn't embraced a women's team.
Yeah, I don't know why that reason is. Obviously, Manchester City, you can see what they've done and with their programme. The women's team are playing at the academy under 21 stadium. They're based there. They're full-time athletes. They eat. They train in the mornings. They eat their lunch there. They're just treated with the respect that I feel like they deserve. Arsenal's going that same way. We are now have lunch at the training ground. We're having a training facility built for us there, so we're going to hopefully move into morning training. So it seems like Man City are leading the way. Chelsea are catching up, and Arsenal will certainly, you know, have been at the forefront for women's football for over 20 years. We fell away a little bit, but you know, everyone, like Lucy Bronze was saying in a session earlier, that Man City are leading, and then they're hoping other men's football clubs will support the programme and everyone move the game forward together. And it certainly seems that there's three clubs right now, Arsenal, Chelsea and Man City, and Liverpool to some extent are making the game boom a little bit.
And are you as angry as some of us are about there not being a Great Britain team in the Olympics.
Yeah, it's disgusting. Yeah. I think it's a great opportunity, not necessarily for the men, because obviously the men, all the politics behind, you know, the nations coming together and uniting, you understand that they want to stand alone. But women's football is different. You need those big tournament experiences and playing in the Olympics for some people. For the Americans, it's the ultimate thing. And certainly for the youth and the development, I think it's really sad that just on the women's side that they can't come and unite. Obviously, we'd want to go together as England.
Yeah.
But I know for a fact that the Welsh FA and the Irish FA, they don't want to put their women's programmes through it. And I just think it's sad because you're stopping the development of your own women's national team in your country.
Finally, Tony, when are we going to see you back where you ought to be, coaching and managing in this country?
I'm not relapsing, David. I'm very happy where I am.
You're very happy.
Very balanced. Azerbaijan, yeah. Europa League. Just qualified for Europa League, Gabala, and five and a half years there now. And I work for a good man.
In Azerbaijan?
Absolutely.
Those and so you're not missing things at home?
He's got a suntan. He's not going to come back to England.
40 degrees, David. I'm on the beach every day, you know. My kids think I'm on holiday every day. I'm actually working. No,
you're happy?
Very happy, mate. Very happy.
Final question then to each of you. What advice would you give to a young player, I don't know, 19, 20, who is worried tonight, this afternoon, about where he or she is at? What should they do?
Ask for help. There are pathways, and it's confidential, it's safe. With a lot of young players that are trying to make their way in the game or other games as well, they're worried about appearing weak in the team, they're worried about not being selected. That's why we create pathways that are confidential, away from the club. Ask for help. And there's no such thing as a stupid question.
We've got a very soft front door. It's a coffee in Costa. You know, we don't got Harley Street, you know, psychotherapist one for one. This guy asked for help, but he'll meet him down the road here and his journey will begin.
Kelly?
I think certainly the women's, the players know that there is this opportunity out there for them if they are, seeking help. I know the PFA have a delegate come in and they speak about what Sporting Chance does. They come out to every individual club. So, you know, if they are struggling, they know where to go.
It's been a privilege for me to moderate this session. Thank you for your inspirational stories. Thank you very much indeed, Colin, for what you do. Thank you for being our panel. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.